Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. It's a great joy to be with you and to follow that wonderful music by Gary with a little of our own Bobby McFerrin, Singing the Garden, which is the open music for this show. We have a great show for you today in this beautiful Wednesday, October 1st, beginning of a new season, just past the equinox, and it's back to school time, and it's back to activism time. It's back to protecting our earth, organizing, and doing what needs to be done. Last week was the Great People's Climate March in New York City, 400,000 people strong. I was there. Today's guest was there. Last week's guest was there. And you were all there with us in either presence or in spirit. And so happy for that. We're going to continue the discussion about the kinds of things that we choose and do as a society that affect our climate. For many years, I've reported on health on Huffington Post, Alternet, iFlip 4 now, EcoWatch, and Tent.com, and a bunch of other venues, as well as my own website, healthjournalist.com. People sometimes say to me, well, how did you get that particular website? The answer is, I've been doing it so long that when the website started, I knew what I was about. I got that website. Somebody was like, you're so prescient. Yeah, I'm like 30 years prescient. I've been supporting, promoting, advocating, using integrative health tools. But the time has come for those of us who care about health to step up for health, food, and the environment. That's what Connect the Dots and all my reporting is all about. So on today's show, we actually have a new and growing organization. And that happens to be one of my personal favorites. Why? Because it really is raising awareness and protecting, seeking to protect the entire Northeast region where I come from and where Progressive Radio originates, even though we reach all over the country and all over the world. Today we'll be featuring a very special organization. You may not have heard of it. I've had a lot of prominent organizations and groups on the show, everything from 350.org. We've had prominent doctors like David Perlmutter, who has the current book Brain. A whole bunch of different things. This is an organization that you may not yet have heard of, and of course, I specialize in bringing these organizations to the front, and these are the grassroots leaders in protecting our environment. This organization, I think you'll be hearing a lot more about, and it's called Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. What is that about? Well, we'll be finding out more on the show. It sounds maybe like it's about one specific thing, but this little one specific thing is really the pipeline that is going to spread and disseminate gas all throughout the northeastern United States, and in the process trample over a lot of communities, a lot of homeowners' rights, as well as create a lot of health problems, some of them of an even greater order of magnitude from the pipelines and compressor stations than what we've already heard about and reported in my online reporting and on this show. So we're going to be speaking with one of the co-founders of SAPE, S-A-P-E, SAPE, Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. And her name is Susan Van Dalsen. She's resides in Westchester County, which is one of, it's kind of currently the turning point moment of this, as it now bridges from all the gas fields of Pennsylvania into New England. She's an organizer, co-organizer of another grassroots all-volunteer group called Westchester for Change, and she co-founded this all-volunteer group, Stop the Algonquin Pipeline. She has been actively working to share information about shale gas development with both local residents and elected officials, as well as organized a variety of different action, including letter-writing campaigns and phone calls, and a range of events, including presence at hearings, rallies, and vigils, and has planned a number of educational forums and has served as a speaker on these issues as well. So, what's happening, Susan is actually, and I'm so thrilled to have her on the show, she's a perfect example of the new model citizen. It used to be said that the environmental movement was kind of like not in my backyard. Oh, don't do this near me, but gee, I still need to put this in my car or whatever. So go do it, visit this problem somewhere else. But actually, it's all the somewhere else's and all the places that all this extends. It's a neighbor to neighbor to statewide, to regional, to national, to international movement of people going not in anyone's backyard, holding hands, connecting, learning tools, sharing understandings, and forming a global movement of people who start at the local level as neighbors and act as citizens and not just kind of say, well, I just don't do it here, but I hope it goes somewhere else. But really, saying, let's come up with solutions, let's not do this anywhere. And this is really what we need to do beyond eating our healthy food and taking our healthy supplements and doing all the good exercise and stuff that we do to maintain personal health. We have to have the same sense of commitment. And that means citizen action. In effect, from her bio, you can hear that Susan Van Dulsen is she's not a one woman because she's with a group, but the group, lobbies, educates, speaks to public officials. We have some very negative influences into the elective process as to who gets selected and who has a voice and who has power. And so really, this is the time of citizen pushback and response in order to maintain democracy and a right to make healthy choices for our planet and future generations. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Susan Van Dulsen.
Hi, Allison. How are you this morning?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for inviting me on the show. It's a real privilege.
Oh, well, it's wonderful to have you here. This has been, I've actually, really been very interested in this. When you hear Algonquin Pipeline in the name of an organization, it's kind of like, oh, well, what's the Algonquin Pipeline? I can't keep all these pipelines straight. We'll be discussing that as we kind of drill deeper into the program. But the thing that first brought this to my attention, and let me just backtrack and just say for a minute for people new to the pipeline issue, we have a lot of shows on it in the Connect the Dots archives, which I'll point you to later in the show. But basically, when the drilling happens, when gas drilling happens in some area of a country or someone else's backyard, and we know it's happening extensively in Pennsylvania, just yesterday, they're going into public parks and wild areas, to with this, then the gas all has to be carried somewhere, either for use in our country or the majority of it for export. And so that means that these pipelines need to be laid, and there are a wide range of health risks associated with them of magnitude wherever they go. So in standing there talking as you are about the Algonquin pipeline, you're talking about the pipeline that is going to go and take the stuff from Pennsylvania and bring it through New York and into New England. Is that not so? Where
That's right.
and how much is known, Susan, about where the pipeline is actually going? So right now you're standing in one community saying, let's not, bring this here, but then do the people where it's coming next, do they know where it's coming next?
That's a good question. The people in New England do know. There are a lot of groups actually that we've been working with. It's a bit of a coalition now. And they're having some challenges in New England in terms of their government, their elected officials. It's ironic because the governor, Patrick of Massachusetts, has made a commitment to renewable energy. So have the two senators, Senator Warren, Senator Markey. But yet the governor signed on to some sort of, it was about a year ago, July of last year, an agreement that they wanted to do more conversions from oil to gas. There's this myth, that you've talked about in other shows and in your articles, that this is a cleaner and domestic fuel and it's for energy security. And that's coming out of the gas industry. If you look at the real facts, it is not a clean fuel. It is not an inexpensive option over the long run, as you said, because of export. And it's contributing to climate change. So it's, to me, it's sort of ironic that a more progressive state like Massachusetts is not fighting harder to stop something like this. And it's upsetting. So we're working with those groups And, of course, New York, you know, we've got this de facto moratorium on fracking, but we're being, you know, being impacted in so many ways, as you had written about in an article last year, including mm-hmm. the pipelines and other infrastructure.
Yeah, that's shocking. I mean, you know, if I could hand pick my favorite senators, I'm sure, you know, right. after Bernie Sanders, Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, you know, they would have to be the top three. Mm-hmm. And yet this is, you know, it's not a, this decision. I mean, the overall decision to allow this to happen, you know, is kind of coming with the executive branch interest and approval, as we've seen from frequent statements by President Obama. And indeed, the Senate and House have not passed the bills that have been proposed asking for health and environmental impact studies of these things. Mm-hmm. But really, it is the governor's decision, you know, at the state level, as we've seen in New York, too. So there you here you have this green state with all these green things happening. And we've also just heard that they're trying to build a pipeline under Lake Champlain. In Vermont, and there we and that's you know been the state that has been the most vociferous in protecting their environment,
right.
And so you know it's not a cause for us to throw our hands up in the air, but it's really people have to really roll their sleeves up and not take for granted, even in
right.
states that are green or progressive, you know what the outcome of any of this will be.
That's absolutely true. You're right, Allison. About that, nobody can be complacent with the industry that's really dominating with the funds, with our government and our campaign finance problems.
Mm-hmm.
We're just up against this huge problem of money, and we as grassroots activists are doing so much and doing incredible things, but it's tough. Yesterday, FERC is the agency that approves this project, Federal Energy mm-hmm. Regulatory Commission. And they just approved this very egregious export terminal in Maryland, Cove Point, Maryland, that should never be. I mean, this reflects what's going on in Washington, that this was approved. It's very near Washington, D.C. It's a very dangerous export terminal that should never be constructed. They did not do a proper environmental impact statement. The activists there have worked incredibly hard. The Chesapeake Climate Action Network and a group in Calvert County. So how encouraging, I mean, it's discouraging to me as an activist, but I have to say, well, let's think of another way to do this, because we know FERC isn't going to stop things, even something like that. And mm-hmm. that's really discouraging. We've got, you know, our federal officials, we've got all the way from the president on down, then we've got FERC. But what can we do, you know, more locally maybe, which is a lot of what we've actually been trying to do with our group.
Let's just backtrack for a second, because I want to hear more about what you've been doing locally. But let's just backtrack for a second and explain to our listeners who FERC or what FERC is.
Well, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is a 5-member commission appointed by the president and approved by the Senate. And it's actually funded by fees coming from the gas and oil industry. It is not a regulatory body of pipelines. What it is a siting agency. So they do the environmental impact statement by NEPA, under the NEPA law, and they then have the release that for public comment. They do a final. And then they are required to either issue a certificate of public convenience and necessity, which would then allow the project to go forward, or they can decline and say that they will take the no action alternative, which almost never happens. They're basically a Washington agency that is pretty much reflecting the needs and desires and wishes of the gas and oil industry.
So there, when you say Washington, Susan, that's a really important distinction, because there's a difference between saying Washington, as in I reside in Washington, my organization is based in Washington, and it's another thing to say federal or government, which means for the public trust and for the people. And so there's a difference between based in Washington, many lobbying groups, in fact, are based in Washington, many the famous K Street lobbying mm-hmm. and law firms and all of that, and being an agency that has any accountability or mandate, in fact, to protect the public. And so, you know, here we have who's in charge here of these decisions, and the answer is, you know, it's not a public agency with any kind of public mandate other than I will decide after I've consulted with the gas and oil industry where it goes and tell you where it's going or exactly. not tell you where it's going. How has secrecy played a role in the evolution of these pipelines?
Secrecy. Well, I mean, the agency is, first of all, not a user-friendly kind of a thing. I don't know if that would be under the heading of secrecy. Mm-hmm. They operate in a very opaque manner. Mm-hmm. They have a meeting every month, and yes, the public can attend. But, you know, for example, the way they're even these people are appointed, the five commissioners, many of them come out of the industry. So I have to guess, and I can't prove, I've read their bios, that they have consultations with people they know in the industry, even though, for example, in our case, they can't specifically speak to the Spectra people. I can't imagine that these commissioners and the staff in FERC never speak to people in the gas and oil industry. I mean, that's crazy, because if you look at the environmental impact statement, the draft that we're working on, commenting on, that we just finished commenting on, it looks like it was written by Spectra Energy. They lifted sections right out of the resource reports in the application. Is that a secret? I think it's a secret to most Americans. They don't know what mm-hmm. this agency does. They have no idea that it even is there, and they don't know how to even approach it. In fact, I found it was just incredible on Monday. That was the deadline for comments. Now, we luckily had a great turnout in petitioning our website. Had a petition, and we had over 26,000 people sign our petition, and we presented those names at our public hearing in Cortland, New York, on the 15th. So that was very encouraging to see, you know, more and more people are learning, I guess, about this pipeline or pipelines in general. They may not understand FERC, but they signed the petition. We delivered them to FERC. But other people were commenting online, and can I tell you how many phone calls were going back and forth and emails with people having problems submitting their comments? It is so difficult to navigate the process. So basically, FERC is not a user-friendly thing. There's no, I asked them, is there an ombudsman if we have questions? No, there are people from the staff you can call. There's nobody in that agency that represents the public mm-hmm. as an ombudsman or a public person, you know, on mm-hmm. in any capacity other than they answer your questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a frustrating thing to deal with, knowing their history, knowing what their approval rating of all these projects is, and the fact that they're not really even seeming to pay any attention or in any way responding to the way the world is changing, as you mm-hmm. described in your introduction. 400,000 people were marching at the UN, you know, prior to the UN conference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are they doing? Are they even thinking about this? That this mm-hmm. is these pipelines with the methane and the incentivizing more fracking, you know, no, it doesn't seem as if that's something they really factor in very much. They have a few sections in their report about it, and they dismiss it.
It's just, you know, let's roll over, and it's really citizens groups holding hands globally mm-hmm. and, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood that are really creating, you know, resisting this and creating change. Let me ask you some more specifics, and we may repeat them in the second half of the show for any listeners who tune in then, because I just feel this is so terribly important. You know, if one isn't looking into health and safety, if one isn't looking into environmental impact, if one is in effect just, you know, rolling over for the energy industry and the public, you know, they don't even manage to have any forum for public discussion, and when public input via the website is overly complex and not user friendly, as you describe, It really is to defeat, anyone taking a closer look or understanding in advance in a precautionary manner what some of the problems with some of these pipelines in terms of their health impacts and what they exude, what those might be. Mm-hmm. So I just want to, for starters, just acquaint our listeners with, and then we can go on and discuss, you know, what a lot of the pipelines have in terms of risk, but there's a very special risk, it seems to me, in the area of Westchester, just half an hour north of New York City, not far from Pennsylvania, and in place where it affects the downstream waters of, I think we were saying 5 million people, in various states and cities. What are the specific unique risks of the siting of the Algonquin pipeline in your neck of the woods, which also affects many other people's necks of the woods? Can you describe to me like what they're trying to do with the pipeline in Westchester that is even more that, and not looking at health and safety is going to be going through unless people stop it?
Right. Okay. Well, this is you're not going to believe this, your audience. It's a new giant 42-inch pipeline, high pressure, that will cross the Hudson and enter Cortland, New York. Verplank is the hamlet, only 1,500 feet from the Indian Point nuclear facility. So that begs to the question as to what sort of analyses have been done. And I guess initially there was a plan they were looking at to follow the existing right-of-way. There are pipelines under Indian Point, old existing gas pipelines. So let's just established that right away. There are three of them. Two of them are used, and the other's like a spare. They've been there since the 50s and 60s, which they probably would never have been permitted now. That was, done many, many years ago, and there's a long story about that. So those exist. They were originally going to follow that right of way to expand one of those to the larger diameter, and they were told to move it south, that it wasn't a good place to put it. I mean, of course not, right? So they moved it south. But this new segment that's going to start in Rockland and cross the Hudson is going to enter this community, and it's just a recipe for disaster. It's coming on land. It's going to intersect with two 1,000-megawatt electric transmission lines that are proposed to come down the Hudson, one from Athens, New York. The other one hasn't been approved yet. It's called West Point Partners, but it's possibly going to come through. Plus, there are two fault lines, the Ramapo Fault and the Stanford Peekskill Fault, right there, and the nuclear power plant with two old pipelines that are operating, and the spent fuel pools. So even if Indian Point were to be decommissioned and shut down, there are 40 years of spent fuel there that cannot be moved to dry cast right now. It has to wait a certain amount of time. Okay, so that's all there. Then if you look very, very closely at the community where this is going to come in, there's an elementary school 450 feet from the proposed giant 42-inch diameter high-pressure pipeline. And then it continues through parks, past many, many homes. I mean, it's just, I don't even know what else to say other than it does not make any sense to do it in this location or anywhere for that matter, but certainly the risks are so high here and the health aspects and the safety aspects are just brushed aside. They have these reports that come out or, some sort of a statement made that they've analyzed and the risk is manageable or it could be mitigated.
This is absolutely kind of horrifying. Mm-hmm. Pipelines through areas where there are spent fuel, where there are faults, which we know, for example, in the Austin or Houston area, I believe, is greatly fracking and pipelines greatly increase the risk of seismic activity and therefore of earthquakes. And it just goes through the roof. And there are many regions, Arkansas, I believe, is another. weather where, you know, we had an occasional earthquake and now we have 400% more earthquakes, you know. So that's what happens when you have a seismically a little bit, you know, changeable area, which you're describing. Also, when you're describing the fact that there are these old buried out of use or, you know, currently in use former pipelines, there's also pockets. We've already kind of delved into the earth there and opened up pockets through which various elements of the process can travel. So it's not just like, oh, it's ironclad, I built a cement pipe, it's in a stable area, it's not near other places where fissures could be created or travel, you know, that the stuff could travel through pre-existing fissures, which is what former old gas drilling sites, as you described, deliver. So here we have like 1, 2, 3, 4 different volatile elements all potentially combining in a region where I don't know how many people reside in Westchester, but, you know, within a half an hour in New York, in the whole New York metro area, I think we're talking about 10 to 12 million people.
Right. Well, there are 1 million residents in Westchester. This pipeline continues from Rockland through Westchester into Putnam. There are 2 huge compressor stations, one in Rockland, one in Putnam. And then, of course, it continues further along. As far as when you were talking about the earthquakes, though, to clarify, this isn't going to be a fracking situation. So it isn't as if we are concerned that the pipeline is a pipeline. Yes, it will have to be drilled through the Hudson to get through in the you know, mud or bed or whatever. I don't think your listeners should think we're saying it's going to induce greater chance of seismic activity. I'm just saying that there is already 2 fault lines, and there was recently a smaller earthquake in Peekskill. I think it was like a 3 or 4.0 or whatever. So that I just don't want people to be conflating the earthquake activity in Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas from injection wells, I don't know, Ohio, injection wells from fracking or fracking itself. That's not really what we're saying. We're just saying there are many risk factors being near this nuclear plant on these fault lines, and it just does not make sense to build this extra huge pipeline in that spot or really at all. And we don't know that there's this need in the first place unless they're going to really export this, and it actually appears that there's no question they're going to export it. And I don't know if you want to get into that now. I can explain that. That's a little more complicated, or I want to go back to that later.
Let's go back to that later because we're going to have our break. But you know, what are the risk factors of doing this near a nuclear power plant?
We have a gentleman that has helped our group a bit and he's an independent consultant, but he is very, very concerned. He's a nuclear physicist. He used to work in Indian Point, and he's a consultant now. And really just talks about, you know, testifies to Congress and assesses situations where there are nuclear plants and what kinds of, you know, things are going on. So this gentleman named Paul Blanche had come to a meeting with us at Westchester County's legislature because he has been so concerned about this project. He even sat there and said to the people in the legislature that the catastrophic consequences could be worse than Fukushima. And this is a man who's very conservative. He lives in Hartford, Connecticut. He's not a local resident. He is sort of impacted, I guess, living in Connecticut by the pipeline, and he's not even speaking about necessarily gas drilling or gas infrastructure. He's talking about it from the point of view as an expert on nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And he has pointed out over and over again to these elected officials, to the NRC, to Entergy that operates the plant, to FERC, to Spectra, that this is an ill-advised place to put this and that they did not do enough of an independent analysis. Mm-hmm. And this man is adamant about it. Yesterday, they released a report that Entergy did, that FERC asked Entergy to do. And first of all, I wonder, why is Entergy performing a risk assessment and why isn't it an independent organization?
That's a good question.
It's a corporation consulting with the gas company to come up with this report. So they did bring in some sort of an outside group to do this report, and I read it, and Paul Blanch read it, and he's commenting now and writing his comments to the people in Entergy that mm-hmm. he knows to say, this is flawed here, this is, he said it looked like a Swiss cheese. This is flawed here, this is flawed there. So we're not just citizens who are upset and alarmed, and of mm-hmm. course, you know, you would be, but this is an expert who is raising absolutely tremendously serious questions that have not been answered. And the Attorney General's office, Eric Schneiderman's office, sent their comments into FERC and drew attention to the same things. They are very, very concerned. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know how much more serious something could be than this kind of a situation, really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's saying that this is what I hear you say, and we're going to stop on these words for a station break, is that this is a risk for a second and worse Fukushima within a range of, you know, an entire metropolitan area with millions of people.
Right.
All right, we're going to take our break now. Stay
you.
With us, listeners. We'll be coming back after station identification to hear more about the dangers of pipeline expansion with Susan Van Dulsen and me, Allison Rose Levy. It's going to be a really interesting second half of the show. Stay with us. Welcome back, listeners. This is Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Connect the Dots. And this is the second half of our show about exploring pipeline dangers. My guest today is Susan Van Dulsen, who's a co-founder of SAPE, S-A-P-E. That stands for Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Expansion. And you can find them, their actions, and more information and both about the pipelines and how to participate and take part in protecting our earth and waterways and food and people from their risks at their website, SAPE, SAPE2016.org. Please do check that out and find out how you can get involved. These pipelines, as we've discussed in the first half of the show, will be spreading all throughout the Northeast. One of the things we were just talking about in the first half of the show is, if you haven't heard it, we'll recap a little bit, but if you're just tuning in, please do go back, or anyone who's interested can go back and listen to the show in the Connect the Dots archives, which will be available sometime later this afternoon and going forward at any time from there. If you are staying with us and have enjoyed the show and are enjoying the show, please do remember to like us on iTunes, as well as pass the information along to your friends who might be interested, or who live in Westchester or New England, or who might be frightened, or New York or the New York metro area, as we discussed in the first half of the show right at the end. And if you haven't heard that, please do go back and give a listen. One of the risks of the pipeline coming through the Westchester area is its proximity to the Indian Point nuclear power plant, which is, you know, a plant that a lot of people are trying to close. It's a half an hour north of New York City. It's right there in Westchester. And some nuclear scientist with whom Susan Van Dulsen and her group, SAPE, have been working, really assesses that the risks of building this new, larger pipeline in greater proximity to spent fuel areas and the plant itself, because, you know, even if the plant is closed down, all of that has to live there for many, many years, because it's, you know, something like 500,000 years that this stuff is still reactive. Is actually a danger that is greater than the one to Fukushima. Hello, people. This is not something we can ignore. Before we kind of move on to other topics, Susan, such as who this gas is destined for, do you have any other further comments about, the kind of ugly risk confluence between gas pipelines and the nuclear power plant?
I think we covered a lot of that with the power plant, and it definitely would be worth people checking our website. We have some resources there. The information that I spoke about from Paul Blanch is on our website. We have a resources link with a lot of things on there. And there'll be more coming up because this report that I referred to at the end just came in from Entergy, and I'm anxious to see the responses to the report, official responses from our elected officials. We worked really, really hard. Our group advocated to town officials and the three counties, Rockland, Westchester, and Putnam, to have these resolutions passed, and they actually did get passed, and they all call for an independent risk assessment. So we're asking these people who are now, you know, in a position to help us, these elected officials, to really take a look at, you know, what is Entergy showing us that they think that they can answer and say that they feel that the risk is not, let me see how they put it, something like the risk from this confluence is, in their assessment, somewhat manageable, but NRC might want to have a conversation with FERC about it, something to that effect. So I'd like to see what our elected officials think about that, and we may have to put out a press release and try to get, I'm so glad I have this opportunity on the radio to talk about it. I'd like to get more media. We haven't had a ton of local media, some, looking at this. So, you know, anything any listener could do to help raise awareness in your community, even if you don't live in Westchester, you know, Indian Point, it would affect, like you said, the whole region. So I think it would be great if the listeners would inquire even in their own communities about what does their elected official know about the Algonquin pipeline expansion and other pipelines and the risk from the plant and, you know, what's just going on here with energy, basically.
Mm-hmm. And you can inform yourself by, you know, what we're talking about today, as well as going to the SAPE2016.org website for more information. And I'm sure that Susan and others involved in SAPE would be very accessible to answer your questions as well. Let's just kind of take a step back. You know, I think for a long time, you know, we had this bad PR pretending that human-generated activity contributing to planetary climate change. You know, people were denying that. They were claiming it wasn't an issue. They were blocking the ability to kind of face up to the problem and address it. But, you know, now more and more, obviously we can see 400,000 people plus many, many, probably 10 times that number nationwide, you know, are getting the message. What about these, sort of ugly interfaces, let's call them, between gas and nuclear power, or about gas pipelines? You know, it's not that maybe people. Maybe people simply don't know they're happening. Maybe they feel that somebody else must be handling it. You know, what is your, or maybe they kind of feel they can't do anything about it, and they therefore they're frightened and they don't want to do anything about it. What is your assessment about what is holding citizens back from really participating and getting these things stopped?
I don't know. I think that there are a lot of reasons. You know, look, just on a practical level, until it's something that comes right to your doorstep, you're busy. People are busy. People know that climate change is real. Most of us do and accept the science, but it seems so overwhelming in a way that they don't understand where they would begin, and that was actually a discussion in a meeting I went to last night, is, you know, how do you follow up the climate march with specific to-do steps? Being involved like I am in this project, in this opposition, is helpful because it's an actual thing. So, but, you know, for the impacted residents, it's so obvious, and they're amazing. We've been so lucky to have joined hands with residents in these communities in Peekskill, New York, and where there's an incredible person named Courtney Williams, and her group is called Concerned Peekskill Residents, CPR, just formed about 6 months or less ago. In Yorktown, New York, there's a group of amazing activists. So, and now we're working in Somers a little bit. And in Cortland, there's a task force that's the town supervisor is wonderful, Linda Puglisi, and she put together a task force right away. So, you know, people should look around them at what's going on in their communities, because that's going to be the thing that they think about day to day. Where does my child go to school? Where do I travel? What can I do to, you know, to change the decisions that are being made around me? And there are things you can even do in terms of just your own personal life, obviously, not fighting a pipeline, but I put solar panels on my house. I've leased them, and it has helped a bit. You know, we still unfortunately have gas powering our heat, which makes me upset. Mm-hmm. So we're looking into that. It's tough from a day-to-day basis for people to get engaged in thinking of the big picture. So start with your community. There are green initiatives in a lot of communities or counties, sustainable practices. More and more people are embracing them. There's community solar starting in certain areas. I don't know if those are the kind of things you're looking for or what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, I really like the fact that you said, that you've done some things, you put on solar panels, but you still have gas. I think people can really relate to that because, you know, one of the problems, I think, is that everybody right away becomes afraid and feels judged. You know, mm-hmm. they say, well, how can I participate? How can I do anything? I put gas in my car. Well, of course, it's not the same kind of gas. A lot of people don't even really understand that. But, I heat my home or, you know, in other words, they feel that it's kind of on them as an individual to unhook from a large systemic infrastructure, and so it's either they feel they can't do anything, or unless they can unhook as an individual, then they have no say in the matter. If they're mm-hmm. still dependent upon these energy forms that are delivered to us by the infrastructure, they feel that they have no say, and that they're just helpless, and they have no voice, right. Or they feel kind of guilty and ashamed, how can I do anything, because I know that I have gas heating my home, and so I actually don't have gas heating my home, I have oil heating my home. Mm-hmm. I really love the fact that you own and admit that, because I think that's a very important part of the conversation. We don't have to be perfect. We don't have to be, you know, perfectly green as an individual. I know some people who really seek to do that and are kind of amazing in their ability to do it. But that, you know, if we had to wait for that, it would be a non-starter. And I think it's really helpful and honest to admit, you know, we're all participants. And that's not about a guilt trip. It's like we basically try to do what we can, disconnect from it as we can, and, cut down use as we can. But really the overarching goal is to have an effect when we all join together on these infrastructures, because then it will be more possible for everybody, to not participate or to have a different source of energy. And that's going to be, you know, a bit kind of hard to come by as an individual. And I think we just need to really be forthright and realistic about that, and not blaming and not judging and not self-guilting and not feeling totally helpless, because the more of us who come together, the more voice there is. And I think, although, the battle is not over yet, you've seen the response from many different people, including elective officials, who are kind of going, whoa, you know, if we really think about this, we really have to take a closer look at this, and they will press other elected officials. And it's really through all of the different group efforts that what we're needing can come about. So,
No, I appreciate what, you know, that you said that, because people do, it is daunting, and there is some shame. I agree with you there. I did not honestly start this all as an environmental activist. I was a community organizing person, much mm-hmm. more so than an environmental activist. Mm-hmm. I became involved when I watched Gasland 4 or 5 years ago and started to learn, and really basically for the last 4 or 5 years feel like I was in like a graduate school program learning everything about energy and about how we get our energy. And it's a lot to take in. Nobody should be expected to be an expert on all of these things. And the best thing that you can do is just to advocate for changes and to accept that it's going to be a slow process, but we're at a tipping point now where we must. We cannot wait any longer. I have three children. We all, you know, have to look to the future. And it can't be a matter of, well, it's too hard to do this, or we need a bridge or something like that. No, we're way past that point now. So what we all have to do, as you said, is join together and do whatever we can on our own level without feeling ashamed. It's the best you can do. Be aware every day. And then think of, you know, your power as a voter and as a spokesperson and, you know, writing letters to the editor, joining a group, even if all you do is go to a film and go to one rally or whatever it is, and feel like you're part of changing the dialogue to say, fossil fuels and nuclear power are old school. That's something that they're holding on for dear life, those industries, because they know they're not going to last forever. Mm-hmm. They know that they can't. That business model is going to change. The utilities, mm-hmm. like Con Edison, we've just got to choke off demand little by little here and say, you know what, we don't want, we're going to move ahead. And there are plans. There are very feasible things out there. It's not like we can't do it. Look, we went to the moon. This country did a tremendous amount of building, you know, the highway systems. It's not like the United States of America can't become a renewable energy country. Mm-hmm. It's a political problem. It's not a mm-hmm. technological problem. Mm-hmm. So everybody, starting with that 400,000 people marching and, you know, all the initiatives that are going on in every community level now, in the places, in my area at least, New York City, the city council's changing. There's a terrific environmental chair named Donovan Richards, who I met and interviewed. He's fantastic. And we just have to push and push every single day and say we're going to demand less fossil fuels. Divestment campaigns you've heard about through 350. There's so many things going on, and fossil fuels and nuclear power are the old model. They're not going to be the business model of the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's the economics, too. It's the environment. It's our health. Of course, everybody's first primary thing is, you know, keeping a planet alive and our kids alive. We need water. We need food. And obviously, without a planet, we're not going to have any of that. We're not going to be here. But it's also, from the business side, it's stupid economically for them not to be looking ahead. And, you know, there was a Times article last week, I don't know if you saw it, about business leading the way in some cases. Now, they haven't gotten there yet, not all businesses, but there are businesses that are starting to say, we're going to just put in, you know, tons of solar panels to power our business. They're mm-hmm. almost ahead of the government at this point, some of mm-hmm. the businesses. There need to be more of this, obviously, but some are starting. I don't know if you know this American Sustainable Business Council. You might want to have David Levine come on your show.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're aware of
that. I've had
a David
Levine on my show. I'm not sure it's the same one.
It may be a different David Levine. He works with the American Sustainable Business Council.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, it's an organization, and they talk about business moving to, you know, away from fossil fuels. And how it's actually the better business model.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so this is, the world's changing. It's not moving quickly enough. Unfortunately, these pipelines are just a dumb thing to be doing. When I was at this meeting the other night in Yorktown, where actually Spectra Energy came to do an open house for another project, which I want to make sure your listeners understand. They're not just going to build this AIM project. They're coming back right after that, and they're proposing another expansion on the same Algonquin line, which means they're going to have more gas going through there to New England. And they showed on a map and on their website, they're going to have a third project connecting to their Canadian pipeline, the Maritimes in Northeast, and it goes coincidentally right to export terminals in Nova Scotia. Interesting, right? Mm. So I had this discussion with one of the Spectra people, and I said, you know what? I know this is your company. You work for this company. This is your bread and butter. But, you know, if I were you, I'd be thinking about what kind of a future are we going to have? Do we want to be an extractive colony? Is our country going to be the place where they just take our resources and ship them someplace else so oil and gas companies can make profit? Or can we say, you know, no, we're going to be a different kind of a country. We're going to do what Mark Jacobson of the Solutions Project said we could do, 100% renewable by 2050. We could.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, what do you expect the Spectre guy to say? But, you know, it was just funny. I just looked at him and I said, you're in a dinosaur business, this gas pipeline thing, unless you want to just ship it to other countries. I mean, if that's what our government thinks we should be doing, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, we haven't talked about that more, but, you know, when we are down to like the last 4 or 5 minutes of the show, but that's a really good point. I mean, when I post stuff about this, people get on, they start arguing with me, you know, they're like, well, what are you going to put in your car? Of course, which has nothing to do with it anyway, but they don't seem to realize that, in fact, a lot of this is destined to be shipped abroad.
Right. And I can send you the map, you know, if you want to put it on your website, that shows exactly what the plan is for this particular company's pipeline system. Mm-hmm. And yesterday, with Cove Point being permitted, which I mentioned in the earlier part of the show, in Maryland, as an export.
Hey, are we back on air again?
Sorry, Allison. I don't know what happened. I'm on a landline. I apologize. Whatever happened.
Yeah, I seem to have a technical problem of some kind there. Well, it's good that we somehow are back. So that's good. It just kind of bugged out for some reason. Well, let's hope it wasn't censorship. I'm actually paranoid.
Yeah, it's a little creepy, right?
in any case, we're kind of down to the last couple of minutes of our show here. But, you know, you're a terrific advocate for all of this. I really, you know, salute the work you're doing. I really urge and encourage, our listeners to support your organization, find an organization in your area, figure out what's going on about this, educate yourselves. And, you know, I like the, you've been doing this for a while. You're seasoned at stepping up and stepping out. You know, a lot of people are more introverted and they're kind of like, oh, well, I don't know how to do this. It's kind of get with other people who do, one baby step at a time. It all makes a difference, and, you know, making your voice heard. Each of us is kind of the center of our own lives. But this is something, you know, we're kind of all in together. It really, really couldn't be more important. And, you know, with what you were saying about, you know, are we going to just be an extracted nation, and all this stuff is shipped abroad? That's also, a very real concern. That was the point where we left off, because the notion is I have to buy into this or I won't be able to heat my home or fuel my car. What we're saying is you have to change the infrastructures so that we can do that in a non-damaging, non-destructive way.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is if we don't make that choice, there's no guarantee that we're going to have it for a car anyway, as it gets or our home or whatever, because it's going to be shipped abroad for profit. And we're just going to be sort of left in the dust, and America the Great and America the Beautiful and America the Preeminent that we all, knew and some of us loved it, maybe no more if we become the extracted. And I think because we're so used to being the extractors rather than the extractees, a lot of people are still identified with that extractor position.
Mm-hmm.
Give me, get me what I need, rather than let's find a way to fill our energy, resources, and needs in ways that are helpful to everybody.
Right,
So thank you so much, Susan Van Dolsen, for what you're doing. Thank you to SAPE. Keep up the good fight. You're actually, everybody in New York City should join your organization.
Yes.
Because you're really protecting the survival of the New York metro area. So thank you so much for being my guest today and being with us on Connect the Dots. Great to have you here.
Thank you for all your work, too, Allison. You're amazing. You're fantastic. You're all over the place. And we just are so grateful to have advocates like you out there, because it's difficult to get enough exposure in the media for the right type of thing. So we totally appreciate what you're doing so much. And thank you for letting me be on the show.
Well, you're very welcome. And I just want to say, for any listeners interested about why these topics aren't better represented in the media, you can go to the Connect the Dots archives. And after you share this program with your friends who need to know about this, you can also check out last week's show with Betsy Rosenberg, where we were discussing exactly the topic. We were both journalists of, you know, why there's a shutdown on the kind of coverage we need in the mainstream media. So, you know, we cover a range of topics. So thank you, listeners, for being with us here in Connect the Dots, and we'll be back with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm Allison Rose Levy.